Hello, this is Peter Fisher, and this is the General One podcast for episode 18, and today we'll be talking about scattering. So it's just over a week to go before the general exam itself, and you should be working along pretty hard, putting in probably a couple hours a day. If you haven't already, it's a very, very good idea to sit down and take a practice exam and go over it. It's also a good idea, if you're studying in a group, to spend some time talking to the other people in the group about things you don't understand. And if you aren't in a group, making an appointment with someone who can help you or finding some other students, you can pick up a lot by talking to your colleagues and sharing notes. It's a very, very efficient way of learning things. Studying in a group is frequently problematic because if you do it too long, then there's always the danger that you're really not pulling your weight and just kind of listening along. So it's really important, if you work in a group, to try to be active, and you go away from the group and work on your own most of the time. One thing I always found useful when I was doing these exams was I would really take off the day before the exam, or at least the afternoon. I would really stop studying entirely and spend the day sort of relaxing. It's a good day to go to the Museum of Fine Arts or the Institute of Contemporary Art or a movie or something restful, and be sure to get home, have a good night's sleep, and eat well before the exam. A lot of how you do, you know, really depends on physically how you feel. And if, in addition to being a little stressed out and anxious, you're tired or hungry or dehydrated, it's not going to help you very much. For the exam itself, you know what to take, and it's also probably a good idea to take plenty of water. Probably smart to go to the bathroom right before the exam, but you already knew that. I'll be posting the last podcast on, I think, the 28th. So, with some final thoughts. I'm gonna drive to Tennessee. Our final topic is scattering, and we'll start by just talking a little bit about the kinematics of scattering, starting with non-relativistic. Most of scattering is, the kinematics are really pretty straightforward. It's a matter of using momentum balance and energy conservation, or momentum and energy conservation. And if you just work through the typical scattering examples, you'll pick up just about everything you'll need. The basic problem is typically you have a target particle and an incident particle, and the target particle is at rest, and the incident particle strikes the target particle and moves off at some angle, say theta, and the struck particle recoils at some angle phi. And you may be asked to, you know, given certain mass ratio and certain velocity, what angles are kinematically allowed and what aren't. The generic approach to any scattering problem is, of course, to move into the center of mass frame, and that's the frame where there's zero total momentum. And that has the big advantage that in the case of an elastic collision, the momentum in for each particle is equal to the momentum out for each particle. And in the case of inelastic collisions, the momenta, of course, are lower, but equal and opposite. So the usual easy way to solve a scattering problem is to go into the center of mass frame and then apply whatever happens, and then the particles are moving back to back at some angle, theta star, with respect to the incident particle's axis, and then transfer back into the lab frame. Of course, you know, what you actually do will depend on what you're being asked. The main thing is to bear in mind that there are really two regimes depending on the relative masses. There's a regime in which if the target particle is much more massive than the incident particle, if the incident particle is much more massive than the target particle, not all outgoing scattering angles are accessible to the incident particle. And so it's just a good thing to work through. There are a number of special cases, or general cases, for example, when the target is much greater than the incident mass, a case where the masses are equal, and then a case where the masses are, where the target mass is much larger than the incident mass. Now, obviously, if the target mass is very much larger than the incident mass, then you're already in the center of mass frame, and you can carry out calculations there. If the masses are about equal, there's an interesting relationship between the lab scattering angle and the scattering angle of the recoiling particle, which turns out they don't depend on the relative masses. I'm sorry, yes, that's correct. So the kinematics, of course, the relativistic kinematics, you just want to be sure to use the appropriate relativistic formula. An important quantity that always comes up in scattering problems is the momentum transfer, which is typically Q, which you can calculate by taking the vector difference between the ingoing and outgoing momentum of the incident particle and calculating its magnitude. And that is a measure of the momentum transfer of the incident particle, or the Q value. And you should be able to go through the calculation of Q, both relativistically and non-relativistically. And as a specific case for an elastic scattering, or potential scattering, Q is equal to 2k times sine theta over 2, where theta is the scattering angle. So this would be the case where either you have a very massive or fixed target, and you're scattering off of a potential, and the incident particle comes in and scatters by an angle theta, and gives up an amount of energy, amount of momentum equal to k. The other important quantity that comes up, particularly in classical scattering, is the impact parameter. Suppose the target particle lies on the origin and the incident particle comes along with a velocity parallel to the x-axis. The impact parameter is the distance that the incident particle is from the x-axis. Basically, if there were no interaction between the particles, how closely the incident particle would pass to the target particle at the point of closest approach. Turning first to classical scattering problems, where you have, for example, Rutherford-type scattering or billiard ball type scattering. What one typically, well, just Rutherford scattering to calculate the scattering angle as a function of impact parameter is a straightforward exercise in Keplerian orbits. The problem can also be carried out by just considering angular momentum conservation, where the angular momentum of the incident particle very far away is given by V times M times B, the impact parameter. And then you can find the half scattering angle by balancing centrifugal acceleration and the Coulomb force at the point of closest approach, which you can calculate from energy considerations. And once you have the half angle, you just double to get the full angle. And the calculation of scattering angle as a function of impact parameter is the sort of the basic thing you need to do to calculate what are called cross-sections. Now, the cross-section is what we're really talking about is the differential cross-section, or d sigma d omega. And the differential cross-section is defined in the following way. Suppose you have a beam of a certain number of particles incident per unit area on a target. The differential cross-section is that flux, number of particles per unit area per unit time, times the cross-section, d sigma d omega, gives the number of particles scattered into solid angle d omega, where d omega is some solid angle that makes an angle theta with the z-axis, or the incident particle's velocity axis, and an angle phi with some other axis. Essentially, any problem I think you'll run into on a general exam will be a central force problem, so the only thing that will show up will be theta. So, differential cross-section, remember, the angular element does not carry any dimensions, and so the units of differential cross-section are square centimeters. Flux are particles per square centimeter per second. So flux times differential cross-section is just has units per second. And that gives the number of particles scattered into an angular element, an infinitesimal angular element, d omega. And if you're thinking of a real detector that subtends some solid angle, delta omega, then the number of particles is going to be flux times d sigma d omega times delta omega gives number of particles scattered into the detector. Applying that definition and the general principle of conservation of angular momentum gives a simple expression for classical scattering, which is d sigma d omega, differential cross-section, is equal to the impact parameter divided by the sine of the scattering angle theta times the absolute value of the derivative of impact parameter with respect to theta. So the whole problem is just finding the functional relationship between impact parameter and scattering angle, and then taking the derivative of that. And you can, of course, work that out for the 1 over r squared force, which would cover gravitational scattering, or Rutherford scattering. One interesting thing to notice, for example, in Rutherford scattering, is when you work out this relation between impact parameter and scattering angle, you take the derivative and then you take the absolute value. So if you think about it, it doesn't matter the relative signs of the charges. It doesn't matter whether you're scattering positively charged alpha particles off of a gold nucleus or negatively charged anti-alpha particles, because dB d sigma is what appears in the cross section, and there's an absolute value around that. Be interesting to think about why that's the case. That's a formula you probably should just memorize or just know. You can get it by dimensional analysis. You know that it has to have the differential cross section has to have units of area squared or centimeters squared, and that means you have to have and it can only depend on B and theta, because what else is there? B encodes the angular momentum, velocity, and mass. So you have to have B and dB on top and sine theta and d theta on the bottom. So that's a simple way to remember this. And you can just work out differential cross sections for a variety of different kinds of potentials. Good thing to try is hard sphere scattering. So you just have to figure out the relation between scattering angle and impact parameter when two hard spheres scatter. Now, total cross section is the integral of the differential cross section over d omega. You have to be a little bit careful because you can have scattering at 0 degrees, so this is not necessarily the attenuation cross section. Anyway, if you have say a scattering foil with a classic general exam is to say you have an incident flux on a scattering foil. The scattering foil has mass density rho. The scattering atoms have masses m. The flux is phi. The total cross section is sigma. How much is the beam attenuated if the foil has thickness dx? And so it's just flux times cross-section times number of scatterers per unit area. Times number of scatterers in the beam. And that last part is a little bit tricky to figure out. If you're told the beam has a finite radius, then you're told the beam has cross-sectional area A, then the number of particles per unit second, per unit time, incident on a patch of area A of the foil is A times phi. So that just has units of particles per second times cross-section. So you need to take into account the aerial number density of scattering of centers or targets, and that's going to be rho times dx divided by m. A frequent mistake is to have extra units of area on the bottom of that expression. Just remember that you have to illuminate a certain number of scattering centers with the beam, and you should only take into account the area that's illuminated once. I hope that was clear. It's not a terribly subtle point, but it is a little bit tricky sometimes. Now, the scattering of electromagnetic radiation has a few subtleties. Two in particular. First of all, since you're not dealing with particles or quanta, you're dealing with electromagnetic fields. So the definition of differential cross-section, d sigma d omega, is power radiated in a certain direction per unit solid angle divided by incident flux, or power per unit energy, incident along some other direction. So remember, it's the ratio of radiated power into a certain solid angle divided by incident power. The second thing is that one has to take into account polarization. This is actually quite important. So it's really the you really need to take into account incident and scattered polarization, and usually one uses linear polarizations. Now, scattering of electromagnetic radiation gets very complicated very fast. So really, the only thing that you really need to understand is what's called dipole scattering. And the basic picture of dipole scattering is that you have some small object whose dimension is perhaps small compared to the wavelength of the you have some small object of dimension d, and you're going to consider the electromagnetic fields distance r away, where r is much larger than d. In order to do this, what you're going to take into account is that the incident radiation causes the charges in the object to move around and accelerate, and since accelerating charges radiate, you need to be able to determine the radiation pattern from these moving charges. Now, this separates quite nicely into two problems. The incident radiation on an object will cause current density J to flow, and J is just equal to sigma, where sigma is the conductivity, times the electric field. J is a vector, so it's a vector J equals sigma vector E. So that's how the incident field sets up the moving charges. From there, you can calculate the vector potential A, which is equal to mu naught divided by 4 pi times the integral of the current density J evaluated at the point x prime, and you're finding the vector potential at the point x, times e to the k x minus x prime divided by the magnitude of x minus x prime integrated over all overall volume. So that's a completely general expression, and so the completely general solution of the problem is use the incident plane wave along direction n hat with polarization epsilon hat to calculate J, and then use the expression for the vector potential to find the vector potential large distance from the radiating element, and then use the expression H equals mu naught curl of A to find the magnetic field, and E equals I times Z naught divided by K times the curl of H to find the electric field. So all of that is fine. In general, it's very complicated to calculate. So typically on a general one exam, one would use the dipole approximation, where current density is expanded in multipole expansion, and only the first term is capped. And the result from that is A is equal to a bunch of constants times omega times the electric dipole moment P times e to the k IKR divided by R. And from there, you can find the electric and magnetic field and then the polarization. I'm sorry, the differential cross-section. Now, all of that said, even that is probably more calculation than you'd want to do on the general exam. What you should be able to do is use basically common sense and the expressions I've given you that you should just work through to, for example, determine the functional form of or the relationship between the initial and final polarization, to demonstrate that the differential cross-section depends on 1 over wavelength to the fourth power. That's why the sky is blue. For a polarized beam along a different direction, give the angular dependence of the scattered radiation. And things on that level, quantitative things, but stopping short of the full calculation. It would probably not be a good idea to try to memorize or go through the entire dipole scattering argument. Simply isn't necessary. And you should be able to apply these arguments, for example, to a small dielectric sphere. And so a small dielectric sphere will have an induced dipole moment that will be along, the dipole moment will be along the direction of the incident radiation. For a perfectly conducting sphere, there will also be an induced dipole caused by the motion of the charges, and an induced magnetic moment. And you should be able to noodle out the effect of both of those. The 1 over lambda to the fourth, by the way, is common to any sort of dipole scattering. And as you go up higher in multiples, the 1 over lambda goes to lambda to the 4 plus 2L, 1 over lambda the 4 plus 2L, where L is the multiple moment. So, of course, this is the kind of the basic argument of why the sky is blue, is this 1 over lambda to the 4th. And you should all be familiar with that great picture that's in Jackson of the solar power spectrum and the absorption spectrum of electromagnetic radiation of the atmosphere. This is referred to as Thompson scattering, by the way. Another really knotty topic of scattering is quantum mechanical scattering. Quantum mechanical scattering, the calculations are actually mathematically and conceptually somewhat complex. And so you should not worry too much about going through all of that. You don't need to memorize the Lippmann-Schwinger equation, for example. The one thing you should kind of know is one-dimensional scattering. So you have a plane wave in one dimension, and there's a step or a square well or something. How to calculate the reflected and transmitted coefficients from that. The other thing is first-order Born scattering. The total cross-section is given by d sigma d omega is the absolute value of f of theta squared, where f of theta is given by 2m over h bar squared times 1 over q times the integral from 0 to infinity of r times v times sine qr dr. So it's really the Fourier transform of r times the scattering potential gives f of theta, and then you square f of theta to get the differential cross-section. And q, in this case, is 2k sine theta over 2. So using this, for example, you can calculate Rutherford scattering in quantum mechanics. There's actually a little trick to this, because if you just set v to 1 over r, which is the Coulomb proportional to Coulomb potential, you wind up with a divergent integral. So what's typically done is you consider a Yukawa potential, and you should take this as an exercise, where v is equal to v naught times e to the I mu r divided by mu r. So the quantity v naught times e to the mu r, all of that divided by mu times r. In this case, mu plays the role of a mass, so this would be a potential that was mediated by a massive photon. You then calculate the Fourier transform of r times that, and what you're left with is f of theta, which depends on some constants, that involves mu, and then take the limit as mu goes to zero to get the actual scattering cross-section. And what you see in this is immediately that 1 over q to the fourth appears, and that should be comforting, because you know that Rutherford scattering goes like 1 over sine to the fourth theta divided by 2. So I would almost advise just memorizing the expression for f of theta, and remembering d sigma d omega is f of theta squared, or the magnitude of f of theta. Closely related to Born scattering is the optical theorem, which no way would you be asked to prove. The optical theorem says that the imaginary part of f at theta equals zero is equal to k times the total cross-section divided by 4 pi. And the interesting thing is that applied, for example, to a black disk, this gives a cross-section that's twice the area of the disk. And in fact, that's a good exercise for Born approximation. Assume that the potential V of R is, say, minus V naught for R less than A and zero for R greater than A, and calculate the differential cross-section, integrate the differential cross-section to get the total cross-section, plug theta equals zero into the expression for f, and use the optical theorem to calculate the total cross-section, and compare that with the integral of the differential cross-section. They should, of course, be the same. To finish up, it's important to sort of mention the typical sizes of cross-sections. Cross-sections are about twice the linear dimension of an object. So when you talk about the cross-section, you're really talking about how big something is. And how big something is depends on what you're looking at it with. And of course, you know, with our eyes, we're used to looking at things with photons. So when you talk about how big a table is or how big a cat is, you're really talking about electromagnetic cross-sections. Atomic cross-sections are typically the size of atoms, and run sort of 10 to the minus 17 square centimeters. A nuclear cross-section, a strong interaction cross-section, is nuclei are about a Fermi, and Fermi is 10 to the minus 13 centimeters, and 10 to the minus 13 squared is 10 to the minus 26. So strong interaction cross-sections at low energies are sort of 10 to the minus 26 square centimeters. And the units used by nuclear physicists and high-energy physicists are barns, and a barn is 10 to the minus 24 square centimeters. So this would be about 10 millibarns, our typical, you know, neutron, protons, cross-sections, things like that. To give you a scale, weak interaction cross-sections, for example, neutrinos at 1 MeV have a cross-section of about 10 to the minus 44 square centimeters. So that is sort of 18 orders of magnitude smaller. So here's an exercise. Use that cross-section to find out what one attenuation length of a neutrino beam would be if you were using iron. So how much iron do you need to stack up to have one attenuation length of a neutrino beam if the cross-section is 10 to the minus 44 square centimeters? Don't be surprised at how big the number is. A factor of 10 to the 18 is a lot. To compare, a typical nuclear reactor, which has to shield against thermal neutrons, will have 8 meters of concrete, typically, as sort of a nominal value of shielding. Cross-sections appear all over the place in particle physics. And another quantity that is used a lot in particle physics is luminosity, or integrated luminosity. That's in a collider where you don't have incident and target, you just have two beams scattering against each other. Luminosity is kind of the number of targets times the incident flux times the area. So integrated luminosity times cross-section gives total number of interactions which occurred. So at, for example, at LAP, the total luminosity was hundreds of picobarns. So a picobarn is 10 to the minus 36 barns. So we could look at, so luminosity was hundreds of inverse picobarns. That's the unit of luminosity. So we could be sensitive to interactions that were, for example, fractions of a picobarn in size. The Large Hadron Collider will hopefully have hundreds of inverse femtobarns, as does the PEP2 B factory at SLAC has hundreds of inverse femtobarns, and should be able to readily detect femtobarn-sized cross-sections. So it's good to be able to review the relationship between cross-section rate and density or luminosity. So that's kind of it for scattering. To summarize, I would sort of drill on the kinematics and make sure certainly the non-relativistic kinematics that I could get through quickly. I would drill on being able to use the classical expression for differential cross-section for hard sphere, Coulomb and gravitational type interactions, and I would be sure I understood the basic phenomenology of electromagnetic scattering, how polarizations scatter and angular distributions for dipole radiation, and make sure I knew how to use the expression for first-born approximation, although that might be even too much to put on a general exam. But just as an exercise, work the black disk and check it out with the optical theorem. Scattering, I think, is one of those things that appears in every branch of physics, so it's really worth learning something about.
A long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile. And I knew if I had my chance that I could make those people dance, and maybe they'd be happy for a while.
There are quite a few interesting things that happened in the last week. First of all, I was at SLAC, the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, and wandered down a hallway near the library. You know, of course, nobody goes to the library anymore. And found some pictures on the wall of, famous people. And they were really quite nice pictures. I borrowed from my friend Neil Calder, who's the director of communications at SLAC. I borrowed it from him, a good digital camera, and took pictures of them. And they're posted on the website. And also, if you have a high-end iPod, you should be seeing the pictures now. There's a picture of my friend and colleague Sam Ting giving a talk at CERN. A nice picture of Henry Kendall, who is also from MIT. A picture of Richard Feynman giving his talk on partons at CERN. And a picture of Pif Panofsky, who built the 2-mile LINAC. Actually, this is the most interesting one. He's a very small man, but very forceful, and you can see him basically selling the 2-mile LINAC. This was in about 1963 to a bunch of guys from DOE in suits. In Nature this week, there's a very interesting article by Frank Wilczek from MIT about quantum chromodynamics. And there's been a real breakthrough in the last year in what are called lattice gauge calculations. These are actually numerically solving the equations that you get from quantum chromodynamics. Wilczek wrote down the original Lagrangian about 33 years ago, for which he won the Nobel Prize. And only now have sufficient algorithms and CPU power been developed so that from first principles you can calculate the masses of the particles that are made up of quarks. And this is really a triumph. They're actually able to calculate the quantum the nuclear potential. And it's quite a well-written article, as everything Frank writes is. In science, there's kind of a strange op-ed piece by the editor about the publisher of Science, actually, about the need for greater outreach by scientists. This is something I go backwards and forwards on. It obviously, to get a lot of funds from Congress to do what we love to do, we have to be able to explain what we do. But our time is limited, and the demands to do this increase all the time. And this article is saying basically that we need to do even more. It's important to learn how to do this. I've done it a lot recently. This being explain what you do to a popular audience. But it takes a lot of time. So basically the guy is saying get used to it. Finally, there is a very interesting article on supernova in Science magazine. There's been a measurement of the polarization of light emitted by a supernova, and it shows the polarization is not zero, which means that somehow the supernova is not spherically symmetric, as one would very, very naively expect. Clearly, supernovas are made by ignition of stars, and stars have angular momentum, so one would naively expect there to be an axis And once you have an axis, you can imagine mechanisms to create a polarization, you know, differential gas flows parallel and perpendicular to the angular momentum vector. And even more, in even more detail, a lot of other things become possible. But this purports to be the first measurement of the polarization. And there's a perspective article and a letter on it, or a research article, which I recommend. Finally, as many of you know, the government's operating on continuing resolution, which means that the budget this year is the same as it was last year. And, of course, expenses have gone up, so this is turning into a really tight budget year. And the Congress has at various times said that they're going to operate on a continuing resolution all year, which will make life very difficult for all of us. So if you can, and I recommend you do, write your congressman or go to your website and have the website, the APS.org website, have them write a letter to the congressman. You know, this is going to impact your future. For example, it could mean that the Tevatron doesn't run, could mean that RIC doesn't run, could mean that the construction of various things is delayed by a year, and times are already tough, and this is just even worse. So flex your muscles a little bit. There are a lot of you, and if you write and tell them how you feel about it, there are articles in both Science and Nature, so if you feel the need to educate yourself before you write, go right ahead.
But February made me shiver with every paper I deliver. Bad news on the doorstep. I couldn't take one more step. I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride. But something touched me deep inside the day the music died.
That's it for this week. That's it for scattering. And this is the probably last full-scale podcast. I'll be posting the next one on Saturday instead of Sunday because your exam is on Tuesday, I believe, and that will be mostly last-minute tips and last-minute thoughts, and so look for it on Saturday evening or Sunday or Monday, but I'll try to put it up a little bit earlier. Remember, I would suggest that you plan something pleasant to do for the whole day, the day before. I would take off from work if you can, and maybe go with some friends and go to a museum and have a nice lunch and spend the day walking around. Hopefully it will be sunny and not too cold. But go to a movie. You've been working hard for a long time and you deserve a day off and a rest. And get to bed early the night before the exam. Try to plan something that may be a little bit uplifting. But certainly don't spend the day trying to cram in the last bit. And if there's anything I can help you with, please send a comment or send me email at fisherp@mit.edu. I'm firming up plans to have a podcast that will start 2 weeks after the last podcast, and what I'm planning to talk about is organization, but more broadly, and I guess more specifically, I want to talk about how to think about your time and think about how to use it and try to make time for you to have the important thoughts that you need to have and make time to talk to each other and how to talk to each other. Initially, I'm planning 10 episodes, and I'll look at traffic to see if anybody's listening and continue past 10 episodes. I'll make some specific recommendations and ideas on
time-saving measures and organizational measures, and there'll be a lot of links to websites. And for those of you who are inclined to gadgets, there are no shortage of gadgets out there, ranging from cell phones to PDAs to stacks of cards arranged in a clever fashion that you carry around in your pocket, and Moleskine notebooks and things like that. So look for that couple of weeks after the exam. And until next week, have a good week. Enjoy your work and enjoy your research. And have a good time in Cambridge or wherever you are.
8 miles high and falling fast, the land is foul on the grass. The players tried for a forward pass with the jester on the sidelines in a cast. Now the halftime air was sweet perfume while the sergeants played a marching tune. Lovers cried and the poets dreamed, but not a word was spoken. The church bells all were broken, and the three men I admire most, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, they caught the last train for the coast the day the music died. And they were singing, bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die. They were singing, bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die.